All right, we're in JavaScript world with some familiar faces that have been on Channel 9. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
I'm Chris Wilson, the program manager lead for the JavaScript runtime engine.
And I'm Alan Werfstrock. I'm the JavaScript language architect at Microsoft.
Excellent. So. And we've had you on Channel 9 with Don Ingalls. That was
Dan Ingalls.
I always do that. Sorry, Dan, who's more likely he's working at Oracle now, I'd imagine.
Is he? I'm not sure where Dan is.
So that was a great conversation. And, of course, you're very well known for your work in Smalltalk. I mean, I think it goes without saying. And you've been spending a lot of time on JavaScript or ECMAScript. And so I wanted to come and chat with you guys. Now, before we get there, Chris, last time we chatted, you were working for Dean.
Yeah.
And now you're over and doing something else. So take us through a little bit what you've been up to.
About a year and a half ago, I decided that, you know, I'd been on the IE team for a super long time. I decided it was time to try something a little bit different, although I'm still super passionate about the web platform. And I came over to the JavaScript Engine team, which is over in a different part of Microsoft, so it was kind of a different landscape, see how things work in a different part of Microsoft for a while.
Excellent. And, you know, of course, we're talking about Chakra.
Yep.
Which I hope to do a little more discussions with you and maybe some other people as we move forward in
Absolutely.
This little series, because you've done great work. So let's talk about ECMAScript. What's going on with ECMAScript 5?
Well, so, you know, first maybe we were talking earlier, and maybe we should just bring, what is ECMAScript? What is JavaScript? How do these things all relate to each other? And just, so JavaScript, probably everybody here knows what that is. It's the language in the browser.
Yes.
And if you're doing any sort of programming that runs in the browser, you're writing JavaScript code. Well, so what is ECMAScript? As some people I've heard say ECMAScript, it's the world's worst language name. So ECMAScript is really the name of the JavaScript standard. And so when people talk about ECMAScript, sometimes, you know, they use it as the name of a language, but it's really JavaScript is what it is. It's a language everybody knows of is JavaScript. And the reason the standard is called ECMAScript goes back 10, 15 years to the politics of standards and trademarks and all sorts of stuff that were going on in the late 90s. And so, yes, the world's worst name was picked for the standard. But when we talk about the ECMAScript standard, we're really talking about the JavaScript.
The next version of JavaScript, JavaScript 5. Maybe call it that.
Well, kind of.
No.
Yeah, but in a lot of people's minds now, I think particularly you know, this year, there's starting to be a linkage between HTML5 and ECMAScript 5, or the next version of JavaScript, in that the newer versions of browsers that support HTML5 features at the same time are supporting ECMAScript 5 features in JavaScript. And so it's really sort of it's part of the next wave of browser technologies that's really rolling out seriously this year for the, you know, for really broadly and stuff.
Absolutely.
So that's what they are. Now, ECMAScript 5 is actually a new standard, and it's the first revision of the JavaScript standard in ten years.
Long time.
The previous version of the standard was called ECMAScript 3, strangely enough, we may get into why that is in a bit, but it's and it was completed in 1999. Mm. It was approved in December 1999, and the ECMAScript 5 standard, which is its successor, was approved in December of last year, December 2009, so it was exactly 10 years. So that new standard now is, you know, based on what we can see and know, talking to our industry colleagues, pretty much every browser vendor is busily working on implementing ES5 features in the browser betas that they're introducing this year and stuff. And so there's a lot of attention on generally bringing the level of JavaScript up to the level that's defined by the ECMAScript 5 standard.
Excellent.
And some of those have been around
for a while, too. Yeah, we talk about what's in it. It's not like everything is new, but
So let me ask you this, and just so people know this, obviously, you guys, well, I know for sure Alan is on the ECMAScript 5 committee.
Right, the right? TC39.
TC39.
Right.
And you're with fellow language geeks and language people from around the industry.
Right.
And you work together
right.
in a friendly way.
Right, right. So, matter of fact, this is my well-worn copy of the ECMAScript 5 standard right here. Right. And I was actually the project editor of this. So I actually did a large part of the actual work of putting this together and
well,
stuff.
Well, congratulations.
So, and doing that and working in conjunction with other people who participate on it. And mm-hmm. Really all representatives of pretty much all the major browser vendors participate. Some other people like Doug Crockford from Yahoo, which is represents more kind of the usage side of things. Mm-hmm. There are some university people who participate. But it's all people who are involved deeply in the JavaScript language and tends to be people who have our language design and language implementation experts who really have deep understanding of not just JavaScript but programming languages in general and stuff. And we try to work together in a very cooperative manner to identify what makes sense to do in the next version of the language that's going to serve the needs of developers who are working in the browser environment and which can be implemented in a compatible and interoperable way across all the browsers.
Sure. Now, over the course of 10 years, you guys, meaning the industry, certainly gathered a lot of information about how the language is actually used by websites and software developers. And as people who aren't software developers also use the language. Then you have people like Eric Meyer, who builds compilers that spit out what is essentially IL. JavaScript is IL for the web. It's a good IL, too. So let's talk a little about what you've learned and then use that as a way to talk about what you've actually done in ECMAScript 5. I mean, you've fixed bugs, you've...
Sure. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that it's not just the language that's evolved over that time, particularly from the time JavaScript was originally invented, the 15 years or so, I guess, since that happened. There's been a tremendous difference in what people are trying to do with it. And I'd say, really, most of the people who are writing JavaScript are software developers just because they're writing JavaScript. It's software, they're developing it. But at the same time, the scale of the applications that they're trying to build today is much, much bigger than it was, 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that puts a lot of different demands on the language and a lot of different demands on kind of the scaling of the engine, the runtime engine that runs that language as well.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah. But it's definitely the case that one of the big changes is that people are trying to build large applications out of JavaScript today. But you still have millions and millions of developers who they do is write two or three lines of code. Actually, they typically don't even write those two or three lines of code. They copy two or three lines of code and then try to figure out some way to edit them to do what they really want. And
that's certainly one of the challenges that we have on the runtime team is that those scenarios and the entire spectrum in between are both really core key scenarios, right? Running a couple lines of JavaScript as an event handler or, stick some content in somewhere or something, as well as, go load this really complex application based on tons of libraries and run that performantly as well.
Yeah. So when we work on evolving the language, as individuals and in an organization, all the browser vendors, and then collectively in the standards groups, that's one of the sorts of tensions we're always trying to balance. Is we have this language that was originally designed to be very simple for people who aren't really programmers, and has
form validation and stuff.
Yeah, it has a number of characteristics that professional software engineers would really kind of hold their nose at in terms of leniency towards errors and stuff that are there simply to be forgiving to users who don't know better. Mm-hmm. Then you have people who are building very, very complex applications and they want a sophisticated modern language. And then you have people, like you mentioned, Eric Meyer and others, who are using it as the back end for compilers and stuff. And each of those groups would like to have different things in the language, and something that's good for one group is not necessarily good for the other. And so just as an example, people who write compilers and are using JavaScript as the machine code that they're outputting the back of their compiler would love to have a go-to. Because, you know, in a compiler, you're implementing control structures and stuff, and that's what a compiler does. It figures out how a control is going to go around, and if you can just put a label and a go-to, that's exactly what a compiler writer needs. Well, certainly, we don't want to give a go-to to a novice, you know, developer, and the people who are doing sophisticated, large structured applications don't want a go-to. Well, so do you put a go-to in the language so it makes it a better language to use to cross-compile to, or do you leave it out?
Mm-hmm. I built some great applications using go-to in the 80s.
Yeah,
well, basic.
Yeah, it was a big debate in the 70s is whether go-to's are necessary or not.
They still debate that, don't they?
Oh, yeah, you know, I think in sort of mainstream software engineering, you don't see go-tos very often.
No. But certainly as an IL, you know, it would kind of make sense. And that's one of the challenges with JavaScript is the need for a flexible language that's very forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little different than what you'd want out of a really performant IL that multiple languages, higher level languages might target.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, JavaScript's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And like the implementations of it are everywhere. So that makes it a good interoperable language.
Well, and particularly,
a good basis.
And particularly in browsers, in the browser environment, it is the one and only universal language.
Yeah,
right?
True.
It's the one language that you know is built into every browser. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can do plugins and such, or browsers that support an additional language, but that's not universal and stuff. So you can't depend, you know, if you're really trying to build universally interoperable code, you can't depend upon it. So it's the one thing that's everywhere, and that's what makes it so attractive to so many people, including compiler writers who want their language, their pet language they're creating. Mm-hmm. I'm not denigrating their languages. There's some great languages people are doing compiling the JavaScript, but they want to get broad usage, and the broadest platform right now that they could target is the browser, and that means
this is true.
Getting out JavaScript.
Well, another good scenario would be, I mean, you mentioned that class of developers who you could categorize as professional software developers. You get paid to write code. You have an educated background, maybe not, but definitely an experiential one. You may want to write a very sophisticated application that targets a browser as the runtime, because a browser is just a runtime, right? It's a virtual machine, just like anything else. You could actually compose your application in, say, C#, mm-hmm. and use all the wonderful tools that go along with it. You like the language, you like that it's static, you know, whatever. And then you compile, out comes a bunch of JavaScript and HTML5, if you will. Then you just throw that into a browser and it runs. That's not a bad scenario where your browser becomes the compilation target.
That's what people are doing.
Perfect.
People are doing that. It's
And so that's a way to... So for some developers who don't... One of the things that I'm noticing in this HTML5 hysteria is that, you know, we're talking about JavaScript as the future of programming for general purpose developers targeting the web. One could argue that may not be the case, but what do you think?
Well, there are different populations of professional programmers coming from different places. If you have programmers who have lots of experience doing C# development or Java development or C++ development, and when they move into the realm of the web and are building the same sort of complex applications they were building before, their preference would be to have a language that is like what they're used to and not this strange dynamic thing that they don't really have a lot of experience with. On the other hand, you take the developers who have started their career on the web, maybe even started at some of these totally unsophisticated, just HTML, you know, designers, but have learned JavaScript and learned software engineering techniques. They're very comfortable with JavaScript as a base language and are building larger and larger applications in it, and they're simply looking for ways you know, better ways to use JavaScript and features of JavaScript that help them in their already sophisticated use of JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have a lot of interest in using a language that's more like C Sharp. They're happy with the JavaScript style language. So.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the JavaScript language. What are some of the key new things, or what are the key things that you've done in ECMAScript 5?
Well, so ECMAScript 5 had, the goal of ECMAScript 5 is really, we said it was 10 years there since the last standard, mm-hmm. so it really was to catch the standard up, the things that had been going on in the usage of JavaScript, and position it for the next generation. So, some of the things ECMAScript 5 does is simply we went through and we found things that every browser, in fact, did, but which the standard said to do something else. You know, so we kind of made it match reality and such. And these are just minor little things that most people wouldn't notice, but the sorts of things when you run a compatibility suite on it, it says, oh, a space isn't allowed there, but everybody, in fact, allowed the space. Here's an example. One just came to mind. So all browsers have allowed string literals to contain a line continuation, that if you were writing a string, you could put a backslash and a new line and then continue the literal on the next line and would ignore the backslash and such. That wasn't in the standard. Mm. So we added that to the standard. Say, now that's a standard capability. Another set of things we did was add features that had been widely implemented, added to the standard. They were non-standard features, but had been widely duplicated among browsers, but not necessarily all browsers, and they weren't yet in the standard. So a great example of that is there's a set of array methods. Some people call them array extras. And they were first introduced by Mozilla, and a number of other browsers over time have copied them. They're just some additional higher level sort of functional oriented methods for manipulating the contents of arrays. So we wanted to make sure those get into the spec. Now, one of the things, and this is an important thing about standards, why you do standards, is, okay, so here's a set of features. You know, three or four browsers have implemented these features. But, you know, each browser, when they did it subtly differently. You know, there are little edge cases of these complicated functions that one implementer chose to do one way and another implementer chose to do another way. So part of doing the standard is coming up with, well, here's the one way that everybody needs to do. So when somebody writes a code, even if this is an edge case, if they write code that runs into that edge case, it's going to work the same on every browser. And so you know, quite a big job, the task that I had to do in doing this document, in fact, was to go through like all the array extra functions and really precisely define what the semantics are, you know, for these algorithms, particularly for all the edge cases. And that's the sort of thing that you get into then interesting discussions in the standards committee, because, you know, vendor X says, oh, no, I don't think it should do this, I think it should do that, and vendor Y says, no, it's the opposite, or somebody says, well, that'd be too hard to implement, or what's going to be in fact. And so, you know, you kind of go back and forth until you come to some consensus that you can all agree to that says, okay, in this particular case, the algorithm is going to do that, and that's what we put in the spec and move on. Okay, so another category of things we did was, another example because we approached it slightly differently. So another feature that was becoming common in browsers was the idea of what most people call getter-setter properties.
Yes.
Right, so a JavaScript object is really a bag of associations between a key and a value. Well, getter-setter property is one where the name is associated with a pair of functions. One function that's called when you assign to the property, and the other function that's assigned when you retrieve it. So it's a more active thing. And it turns out getter-setters are important in the web environment because much of the behavior of DOM objects is only understandable in terms of getter-setter behavior. You assign something to a property, you assign something to inner HTML, and suddenly this, you know, you just assign this string and suddenly the whole rendering of your page changes or something and such. Right. And so whether or not in practice in the implementation that was at the low level implemented as a getter and setter to a JavaScript programmer, that's the behavior that it appears to have. And so, you know, we definitely wanted to bring this concept of getter and setter into JavaScript so JavaScript programmers could do the same thing. Well, there was an implementation of that that was implemented in a number of browsers. And as a group, we looked at that and said, well, you know, this design of this feature is not so great for a number of reasons. Here's a particular API that was used to implement that, and, you know, the first red flag was, well, the methods in this API all began and ended with double underscores. Right, and so what? Do you want to have a feature in the language that looks like it's an internal use only or an experimental feature or not?
Sure.
It seems like not a good idea. All that good of an idea. But then you know we went further and started looking at well, you know, different browsers they're using these same API names, but they do different things for all these. And if we just went and picked one set of and these aren't just edge cases. Some of these are pretty central cases. So if we just picked one meaning and said that's going to be the meaning, then all the other browsers would have to change what they do for that, and that's going to break code that people have already written to run on specific browsers, right? Because we knew, you know, anybody using getters and setters, since it wasn't a standard feature on all browsers, must be writing code that was targeting some specific browser.
Yep.
And, you know, nobody wants to break code of users, you know, whomever you are. And so if we tried to somehow, you know, have least common denominator or something, that would kind of break everybody's code. We didn't want to do that. So eventually we actually sat down and we looked at some other requirements, other things we were trying to do in ECMAScript and said, well, there's another set of capabilities, which I'll talk about in a second, that could be closely linked to this, and we actually sat down and designed a new API that provides support for getter-setters, but also provided support for some other capabilities that we needed to have. And so that's an example where in the standards group, instead of just taking something that was already common practice, we took a functionality that was agreed upon we needed, but we actually sat down and designed a new way to integrate into the language that was better than anything that's gone before.
Excellent. One would hope that's what happens in a standard.
Well, you do various things. Like I said, you clean up things, you know, and you say, oh, let's fix the standard to match reality. You take things that have been introduced that are good, and you essentially bless those. You say, yes, those are good, and they're included. And you take things that people want for which there isn't necessarily a good solution, and you try to come up with a good solution. Now, a good standards group, probably those first two things should occur more often than not, and the third one is kind of, you know, the last resort in some cases, because, you know, everybody has stories about, you know, things, designed by committee and such, and so, you know, a standards committee is not necessarily the best venue to do really good design, but when you have a group of talented people who are experts in the area and they're committed to doing something, you can get good stuff out of it. So I mentioned, so there's another set of functionality we kind of combined with getter setters. So another thing we wanted to do was a big change over the last 10 years was the emergence of JavaScript frameworks. Okay, we didn't have frameworks 10 years ago. Now we have widely used frameworks, and one of the problems was that the developers of frameworks, the way using the old standard, weren't at equal footing with the designers of ECMAScript. So as the designers of the standard language or the implementers of a browser, you could do certain things with the function libraries that you weren't able to do as a framework writer having to write code in JavaScript. And a real common, just a really simple example of that is, so it's a pretty common thing in JavaScript to take the interface for an object, let's say the array interface and the set of methods that it has, and to implement those same methods on another object so it can be used interchangeably with an array object that has some slightly different characteristics and stuff. Well, one of the characteristics of all of the built-in methods in JavaScript is if you for in enumerate over an object, you don't see them, right? But if you sit down, if you're a framework builder and you sit down and you define the exact same methods on an object and your user enumerates over that object, they see all these right. methods you've added, right? So while the framework builder should be able to, ideally they want to build libraries that have the same usability characteristics that the built-in libraries have, they weren't able to do it because you couldn't, the language didn't expose the hook that said, well, this is a property, but when you do an enumeration, don't show it. So basically, with every property in JavaScript, there's a number that come attributes that control things like whether it's enumerable or whether that property can be deleted or whether you can modify that property in different ways or whether it's read-only or not. Mm-hmm. Read-only is another good example. There are built-in properties that are read-only, but there's no way the framework builder could define a read-only right. property and stuff. And so, one of the big new things we did in ECMAScript 5 is we exposed JavaScript programmers, including framework writers, the ability to, when they define properties, to control all these attributes that control the use of the properties. And that was the thing that we discovered actually combined very well with defining getters and setter properties, because that's just another aspect of defining properties and the attributes of them and stuff. And so we were able to create an API that combined the ability to define getters and setters with the ability to control the attributes and stuff, and created this whole new API set for ECMAScript 5.
Excellent. That's sort of categorized as DOM object emulation or emulating a DOM.
That's one of the uses of it. That's one of the uses.
In the browser.
Yeah, in the browser. And that's very much one of the goals, kind of the design goals in ECMAScript 5 is kind of the ideal that we haven't quite reached yet, but we've gotten a whole lot closer, is in theory a framework builder should be able to build the DOM.
Yep.
In JavaScript. There's no reason that you should have to leave JavaScript to implement the DOM.
Excellent. So what about, like, there's work in the Reflection API. I mean, I'm just trying to go through a few things here. Mm-hmm. The sealed or frozen objects and function bind.
Well, attributes is sort of the Reflection APIs and stuff. Sealed and frozen object is another set of capabilities people who are interested in building more reliable and more secure JavaScript systems would like to be able to define objects and, say, pass them into some code that they've loaded from a remote site, mm-hmm. and safely pass those objects in and be sure that
they won't get mangled
or something. So be able to take an object and say, this object is, what sealed means is essentially that you can't add any new properties to it, and you can't delete any properties, and you can't do strange redefinitions of properties. So the object is what it is. It may be rewritable and stuff. They can assign values into it, and so it can be passed in, and you know pretty much that the object that you passed in is the object you're going to get back out and such. And so these are sort of security-related or reliability-related extensions and such.
Excellent. Now, what about function, that prototype, that bind?
Well, function at prototype.bind, yeah, that's one of the new things. So every function in JavaScript can be used as a method. Or a method on an object is simply just a function, and every function has a implicit argument called this, which when you invoke the property on an object, the this value of the function gets bound to the object that gets associated with. It's pretty much like this in C++ or C# or Java, or in Smalltalk world or Ruby world, they'd call it self. It's the object that the method was invoked upon. Well, in JavaScript, one of the things you can do, since functions are just the values of properties, you can actually reach into an object and pull out a method and have it, you know, have it in hand, have it as a reference, and say, well, here's, and call that function. And it's been disassociated from the object that was originally attached to. Well, sometimes you want to be able to pull out methods like that, but you want to maintain that association. You want the this value, the function, to always relate back to the object that it originally came from. Mm. And so what bind does, it takes a function, and it permanently assigns a value to its this finding. So now if you call that function, and you don't even if you supply a this value, it's going to use what the original this value was and such. It will do the same thing with some of the arguments. For the people, the listeners in the functional programming world, a bind is really a curry function. It takes a function, creates a new function, which calls the original function, but with some of its arguments set to a predetermined value.
Excellent. And now, of course, after people are going to be watching this, and they'll definitely be playing around with IE9 Beta 1. Mm-hmm. So congratulations to you and team for being a part of that epic project, because I think not in marketing, but it has, those guys are really pushing the envelope with general purpose web browsing, what IE is doing. Absolutely, man. And we're going to see a lot of the stuff in the beta we've just been talking about.
Yep.
Now, real quickly though, I mean, when you make changes, things break. But of course, you said we were very careful about not breaking things. So, is there going to be a compatibility mode?
Well, so we're always trying to be very careful with not breaking things, like in the world of standards.
In the standards.
Yeah.
In the standards, although on occasion, things do get broken. You make a conscious decision to break things. And technically speaking, at the level of the standard, you couldn't make any change or any addition without technically breaking something. Right? Okay. Because the fact that, you know, you add a new method, well, the fact that that method wasn't there is a change. And there could be code that was dependent upon the absence of something as opposed to its presence. So doing anything potentially is a breaking chains, and so you have to do some of that. At the level of individual browsers, and particularly at Microsoft, we actually have a much higher bar of compatibility. We if a user has a web app that they have built and tested against IE8 and it runs reliably, we really, really want that to work unchanged in IE9. Now, maybe we aren't always perfect in that, but that's the ideal we work for. And we work very hard for going as far as we create what we call compatibility modes in the browser. Yep. So it really every release of IE now, certainly the last IE8 and IE9, have what's called a standards mode, which is the mode, if you will, it's the native mode of the browser. It's the mode that
it's
the default mode and supports all the latest versions of the standards that we have been able to get into that version of the browser. And in IE9 standards mode, ES5 is our baseline target for JavaScript, and all the DOM functionality is based on whatever the current DOM standards are. Chris knows a lot more about those things than I do. But we also have IE8 compatibility mode.
Yep.
And in IE8 compatibility mode, what the version of JavaScript we support at the the language features are exactly the same as what's in IE8. And there's an IE7 mode where it's exactly the same as what's in IE7. If you have an app that is really dependent upon some obscure feature in IE8, you can set it so it will run into that mode and it will work. And this actually is something that enables us to start evolving the standards mode platform in ways we haven't done before. So, like in standards modes, one of the things we've done with JavaScript there, not just have we implemented the ES5 standard, but historically in JavaScript or JScript, as we used to call it in the browser in IE, there was a number of variations from the standard that were really deeply wired into those versions of JavaScript, things where we just did things differently. And some of these go back to the earliest days of the browser where at Microsoft, we made a decision to do a certain feature in a different way, and Netscape or whomever at the time, you know, made a decision to go in a slightly different way. And then because of compatibility, you kind of get locked into that decision and you can never change it, because there's always a possibility that something's going to break. Mm. Well, in IE9, because of our use of compatibility modes, we were able to fix those things, if you will. So there was actually quite a number of quirks of previous versions of Internet Explorer JavaScript, which worked identically now to what the standard says and what other browsers do in standards mode, but in these compatibility modes still have the same old quirky characteristics they had before.
And, I mean, that's one of the real challenging things about what you guys do, because, you know, most of the apps in the world run in web browsers. We know that. I mean, it's a no-brainer. That's how the world works these days. So you haven't said very much, Chris, because we've been focusing a lot on ECMA. But what would you? Can you touch on a few things related, maybe to the DOM work that you've done, or some other things?
There's been some tremendous amounts of work in kind of improving how the JavaScript engine and IE work together on providing the DOM to the ECMAScript engine. And I was in the IE team when we first started building those pieces of building a DOM and connecting that and having that be a really dynamic programming platform. And it's super flexible, the way that we originally implemented it, and it was probably a little too flexible in a number of ways. And I think that we've seen some dramatic speed-ups, not just in the JavaScript engine execution, but, you know, core JavaScript execution, but in how the DOM hooks in and getting rid of a lot of problems with memory management across that boundary, which is always kind of the area of problem. I think there's been a ton of work on performance in general just throughout the entire system of IE and the JavaScript engine. That's definitely, you know, our big focus has been not just implementing the standard, but implementing it really fast and making sure that we, you know, pay attention to all of the other aspects of performance.
Absolutely. And one of the things, we'll touch on this in another interview perhaps, is the work you did with FastDOM, which you just talked about, moving the comp. There's no longer that comp bridge between the app.
Not really. It's not like the old intersection of those that we used to have was pretty... it was kind of a, well, I want to call something on this object, go, you know, figure out and discover every single time what it is that you want to do and how to call it on the other side. And that was kind of costly.
Sure. And, you know, just to wind down, I mean, ECMAScript 5, excellent. You guys ratified that?
Yeah. It was approved as an ECMA standard in December, and right now, it's in the process, the fast-track process, to become an ISO standard.
So awesome.
It's an official standard right now, and it will even be a more official standard. These are just different standards bodies like to be able to add their
stamp of approval.
Yeah.
And, of course, you get to work on the next one where, you know, hopefully there'll be lambdas and interfaces and, you know, God knows what.
Well, JavaScript has always had lambdas.
Really?
Yeah. That's a JavaScript function is Except for the most technical of our listeners here would say, yeah, it's a lambda expression.
You got him started.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
You got him started.
It's fun to get him started. It's great to listen. I could just keep on going.
But so things people are looking at for next versions of JavaScript, more things to help these more sophisticated programmers, modularity, how do you manage larger programs and stuff and compose the pieces together and stuff, and various language features that enable, again, dealing with more complex programs is a lot of the focus for the next go-around, and we'll see how long that takes. It hopefully won't be another 10 years.
Please, not another 10 years, man. Hey, great to meet you. Well, we already met, but, great to see you again.
Always
it's been a while. Great. And great job, you guys. Congratulations. Thanks.